You're listening to Interviews with Adam. I am your host, Adam Miller, and today we're joined by Aaliyah Joy, who's written a book called Glorious Weakness, Discovering God in All That We Lack. It's a great resource, especially as we want to encourage you to understand who you are in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. Aaliyah, thank you so much for being a part of our many voices for that one message and for being willing to talk to us about your book.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Why don't you get started by telling us a little bit about yourself and how your background leads us into the story of your book?
Well, I am. I never thought I would be writing a book, especially one quite as personal as this one. But I am a wife. I'm a mom of three kids. My mom, who is a widow, lives with us. And over the last, I would say, decade or so, I feel like I have really been experiencing this sort of profound depth of weakness. I remember going to a conference and speaking, and I remember distinctly thinking, what if weakness is my actual like gift? What if it's my spiritual gift that God has given me? Because it felt like everywhere I was called to, I was showing up weak. I have mental illness. I have bipolar disorder. I have chronic physical illnesses that have, I've been in and out of the hospital many times. My childhood, I had leukemia. I've just been through a lot of different things. And so I remember really wrestling with God. Like, I feel like I could do so much more, bring so much more to glory to the kingdom if I could just stay well, if I could just speak and write and travel and do all of these things and serve in my church. And what ended up happening is a lot of times I was writing from a hospital bed or from the depths of my depression or from just really, really weak places crying out to God. And that's kind of how this book started. That was kind of the place, the questioning of what can God do with somebody as weak as I am?
When you're suffering and you feel like you're going through these circumstances, you often feel alone. And I'm sure in the process of not only blogging about a lot of these things, but writing your book, you've been able to interact with other people. Does that sense of community remind you that this is something that we often face across the board, we just don't talk about enough?
Yeah, I think that was one of the, when I started blogging originally, I had a completely different mindset for what I was going into. It was going to be a hobby. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder very late, and I kind of go into some of the reasons why in my book, but I wasn't diagnosed until 2012, and so during one of my manic phases or hypomanic phases, I decided I was going to start a blog. It was going to, I'm going to make money. I'm going to do this, and it was going to be like a do-it-yourself home decorating design blog, which for people who know me, it just makes no sense. But that was originally what I thought I was going to do, and it was really pretty short after that I went through one of the worst depressions of my life. And I had this blog and I just started writing through it. And I wrote really brutally honest things about walking with God in the dark and not feeling his presence. And, that heart cry that you hear in the Psalms of, where are you? Have you forsaken me? Are you gone? And yet still having the faith to cry out to him, even though he feels absent. And I think it resonated with people. People started showing up and reading. And originally, it really was sort of a lifeline to know that I was not alone in the dark and alone in this really isolating time. But then over time, it sort of transitioned as people started showing up to realize this is a ministry also to show other people that they're not alone. And that there are people that have walked through this. And I've really found that the primary amount of my audience are people who have suffered and just have no, or feel like they have no place to express that pain and the doubt that they might be feeling. And, they're trying to protect their testimony. I write in my book that our testimony is only ever how God is faithful to us, not the other way around. But I think as Christians, sometimes we think we need to perfect our testimony. We need to pretend that we're super strong all the time and that we, that we have it all together and that we're doing the good Christian walk. And sometimes we're afraid to admit how scared we are, how alone we feel, how desperate we are for God's presence when we don't feel him, even if we believe, you know. I feel like so much of my life has been crying out, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. And there are so many of us walking that journey. So connecting has really been a huge blessing to me, and realizing that this is a ministry of weakness.
Now, this is, you mentioned something that I think is really important. It's throughout the theme of the scriptures, there is an attitude of our weakness and God's grace and his strength, that we're to rely on him. But yet we lose that perspective after we become Christians and we try to present a strong front. Why do we lose that perspective when it's so prevalent throughout scripture?
I think that we as a society enjoy the concept of, you know, power made perfect through our weakness. I think we get it as a concept. I think if you ask any, you know, Christian who's been around and has read the Bible, they will agree that that is truth. I think when you practice it, it's a different thing. I think our culture despises weakness. We hate to be lacking. We hate to show weakness. We hate to show that side of us. We want to present, you know, this part of us that looks cleaned up. And I think, you know, for me, it was a lot of the same. I came to Jesus when I was desperate. I got saved and got to know Jesus and was walking with him. And it wasn't that long after I became a Christian that it was like, okay, now I'm a Christian. Now I have this hope and I should have it together. Like, I have this hope of knowing Jesus. I have this relationship with Jesus. It should all be, you know, perfectly, like, together. And I think a lot of us have been sold that lie that there's this sort of prosperity gospel undergirding what we believe, even for people who say that they don't believe that. I think we really do. I think we see God as this sort of, you know, fix it, that it's supposed to be this way. And we doubt when things all go sideways. We doubt when things are really hard. I've had people tell me, you know, you must be lacking faith, you must be in sin, you must be, you know, all of these things, because I've suffered with mental illness, because I've been chronically ill, because we've been through seasons of, you know, poverty, like all of these things people wonder, you know, well, what did you do to bring this on? Instead of seeing God's hand in meeting us in these places that are really difficult, I think we're just not very honest about how hard life can sometimes be as a Christian. And there just isn't always a space to talk about that. There isn't a space to show up continuously weak. I think we're a society that doesn't mind crisis. If my house burned down, I guarantee you that I'd have a GoFundMe up and people would rally around and they would bring meals and my kids would get clothes. Like, people are great in crisis because there's an end to it. It happens and then everybody rallies. But weakness that goes on and on and on and has no end in sight, when somebody is just hemorrhaging need, that's harder to say, I'm going to walk this journey with you. Even if it never ends, even if, you know, there is no fix, even if there is no cure, even if you stay sick, even if you continue to be depressed, like, I'm going to journey with you. That costs something, and people are not necessarily willing to do that.
If we think through all of the kind of ways in which we have presented ourselves in the strength that we exhibit, the internal weakness seems to be one that offers a lot of shame and secrecy to it. But yet, throughout the Word of God, throughout Scriptures, we see people who are making mistakes. We don't see any perfectly clean characters throughout the Old Testament or even any of the disciples in the New Testament. And all of these characters are presenting us people that are needy. Why aren't we more willing to see ourselves in those stories and see ourselves in the grace that Christ has demonstrated towards us to those who are suffering in similar ways?
Yeah, I don't know what the you know, actual block is. I think it might be different for different people. But I do think that we have the tendency to picture ourselves in the hero role. I think that's pretty common. You know, people read the Bible, and when the Pharisees are being rebuked or when somebody's being rebuked, we tend to be on the side of thinking, well, we're not like that. And it becomes a sort of moralistic, prideful place that we can say, you know. I think it's common in churches to believe that grace is the thing that sort of gets you saved, right? It's that exchange, it's the, you know, prayer or altar call where you say the thing and then that kind of gets you in, you know, in the gate. That's the ticket. And I think a lot of times salvation is sort of packaged like that. You know, you do that if you want to ask Jesus into your heart. I mean, I remember being a teenager, a kid, and going to youth group, and I think I got saved 100 times. I mean, every altar call, I would ask Jesus in my heart again because I wasn't sure if it took, you know, like I wasn't sure if it really happened and I didn't feel any different and I was still sinning. And I, you know, I just didn't understand that it wasn't this transactional thing to get me, you know, in the gate to be a good Christian. I mean, that's really what I kind of grew up imagining grace to be. It was this thing that got you through. But then afterwards, you work super hard to be pleasing to God. And the understanding of grace, you know, as an adult, when I really started to understand what grace actually meant, that I could be severely depressed and unable to serve in ministry and unable to, you know, my body could be broken. I could be in a hospital bed and unable to do a single thing. And God was pleased with me and loved me and His grace covered me, you know, even if I wasn't productive, even if I wasn't successful, even if my life was, you know, this weak crying out to Him constantly and need and desperation, that God cherishes me and that He loves me in that place, and that I don't have to do anything to prove myself to Him because He's already covered me with Christ. And so to me, that concept was revolutionary. And I think a lot of people think we understand grace, but we still see it as this transactional thing. We become a Christian and then we live this life of, you know, following all the rules and being a generally good person. And I think that somewhere along the line, sometimes we forget that grace is this constant need that we have. It's not just this one-time thing. It's this thing that covers us as we walk through life with Jesus, and that He's continuously showing His grace to us and His mercy and His tenderness and His kindness to us. And realizing that and being able to see that in my life in the midst of, not because the pain has gone away, but in the midst of the pain, in the midst of the brokenness, in the midst of the incredibly hard times, realizing that God's grace is sufficient and that He is there with me, and that the answer isn't necessarily, you know, being skipped down the line to the happy ending. I may never get the happy ending or the healing or the, you know, all of the things that seem to, you know, be the fix in our world, that we would think, you know, this is the proof of God's faithfulness to me that I'm healed. This is the proof of God's faithfulness that, you know, my husband doesn't lose his job, or we don't have to move, or we're not saddled with, you know, thousands of dollars in medical bills. Like, that would be the outward fix that a lot of people are looking for, but the actual true fix is God's presence. And when you realize that, grace just becomes everything. And at that point, there's freedom. I'm not as ashamed of my weakness now because I know that God's grace is sufficient. He proves that to me over and over again.
We often talk about this on our broadcast. We talk about grace. We communicate grace with our words, but we don't often articulate that in the way that we go about our lives. We act as though our grace has been given to us because we earned it, while not actually confessing and proclaiming and demonstrating that this is a gift that God has given to us. How have you seen, in your understanding of glorious weakness, the value of living out as a person that has been given a gift?
Yeah, you know, I think when I first got saved and at the beginning of my walk with Christ, I didn't live that out. I lived it out very much like, I was going to do all of these things for God. I remember, you know, becoming a Christian and I was extremely zealous. My parents had been missionaries in Nepal in the early 80s. And in my mind, being a faithful Christian was going overseas to, you know, some country and sacrificing and living for, I mean, that was really the ideal of faithfulness, right? And it really did become sort of an idol to me that this, you know, I didn't ask God if that's really what He wanted for my life. I just was like, this is the way to do the thing. You know, this is how you're faithful. I go do the thing that seems the most extreme. And certainly people are called to different things, but I didn't see the value of a life that was just surrendered whether I live in the suburbs, surrendered, whether or not my husband works a 9-to-5. You know, my husband's a painter. He works in construction. We've lived for the last 20 years here in Central Oregon, and he's worked construction, and I've been a stay-at-home mom, and life has been very mundane and ordinary. My physical illness and my mental illness has meant that we are not able to do a lot of things, and so there's an ordinary faithfulness to our life that that I didn't want, that I didn't expect. I thought God was going to use me to do these big, powerful things, and when it came to my identity, so much of my identity and my pride was wrapped up in that, what I could do for God. And my understanding of grace really didn't happen until I was, you know, at my lowest, at my weakest, at my most desperate. What I realized is, you know, in being in that place so often, being in that place of just utter desperation that, you know, if I need you or I'm going to die, like that desperation for just a touch from God, that desperation for his presence, impacted me in a way that nothing else has, because I think a lot of us would say, you know, yes, God is all we need, but we don't live like God is all we need because we have other options, right? We could insulate ourselves with our good choices and our safety nets and all of the things, you know, our good health and our good success and all of these things that we can add to sort of our good life, our life of faithfulness. But when you have things stripped away, and you're at sort of the end of yourself, which I feel like I've been at the end of myself so often. And it is really that place where I realize that it like God is what sustains me. God is what keeps me here. God is literally what has kept me alive during times when I've had suicidal ideation, when I've had, you know, struggles with things like God's presence. Whether that be through a kind psychiatrist or meds or, you know, my church family or, you know, the different ways that he's met me, that desperation changes the way that you see grace. It becomes sustenance. It becomes so necessary. And when you're at your weakest, you realize you really didn't do anything to earn it. I mean, you know, there are times when I'm literally counting, you know, I will survive for another 300 seconds. I will survive for another 500 seconds. I'm laying in bed. I'm almost catatonic. I'm waiting for, you know, my meds to kick in. I'm being watched because I'm, you know, struggling with suicidal thoughts, and my bipolar disorder is horrible. And yet I'm calling out to God, and he's faithful. He's faithful even then, even in those times, he's faithful, and his grace is sufficient.
We talk about weakness, and even in telling your story, it can sound rather overwhelming and frightening and disturbing. What makes weakness glorious?
It is frightening and overwhelming and scary sometimes. I mean, the truth, I'm not going to, you know, lie and say it's been a cakewalk. It's definitely, there are hard times. There are a lot of people that suffer, whether they suffer, you know, the kind of things that I've gone through or other things. You know, this world hurts. And to find the glory in that is definitely, I believe it's miraculous. I believe it's God giving us the eyes to see. I talk sometimes about small grace is not so small, and learning to look for the goodness of God, that belief that I will see his goodness in the land of the living, that even in the midst of these really hard things, that God is present, and that he, that his heart is tender, and that his desire for us is always our flourishing and his glory. And those are not opposed concepts. I think sometimes we think for us to flourish, it has to be this one way, and for God to get glory, it has to be this other way. And when we're hurting, it can be hard to see, you know, are we flourishing in the midst of these incredibly hard times? You know, is God getting the glory when everything just seems really dark and terrible? But I think that what makes these hard things and this weakness glorious is that during these times, God is, there have been times that, you know, I can place where I go, I can't do this without you. I can't do this in my own strength. It, you know, whether it was speaking, there are times that I was speaking and I, you know, because of circumstances, I was sick right up until I took the stage, and I couldn't breathe. I mean, there was times when my asthma was so bad, I couldn't breathe. And I thought, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this talk. And, you know, I remember praying, Lord, you know, if you will, even the rocks will cry out, you know, give me breath. And he kept my lungs open for that session to be able to preach about God's glory and in the midst of, you know, weakness. And so during those times of desperation, what I've felt, what is glorious, is that God's presence is so tangible and so strong, because there's space for him. There's room to really realize and recognize and esteem him as a God who meets us in that place, a God who doesn't just show his presence to us, but works to empower us in the midst of, you know, times when we don't have our own power, when we don't have our own strength, when we don't have our own breath. And I've seen that over and over again, the way that God works with somebody who is willing and who is open. And whether it's some big miraculous thing or some small, you know, some small grace, learning to pay attention to it, learning to see the hand of God moving in our lives and to give thanks for it. It's glorious, you know, it's glorious in a way that somebody who hasn't been through it may not understand. But I think as we surrender to our weakness, and everybody has it, whether you've suffered the way that I've suffered or not, everybody has weakness. Everybody has that and struggles with that inside of them. And I think when we stop trying to overcompensate and we learn to rely on God, the result is he's able to work in miraculous ways. He's able to lend his presence to us, and that relationship deepens and that trust deepens. I trust God way more now after all I've been through than I did when I was first starting out. I'm quicker to trust him because I can look back on my life and I can see these altars to remember, these things that I've written down, these reminders of God's faithfulness to me over and over and over, you know. And like I said, sometimes that faithfulness is psych meds that work, you know. Finding an antipsychotic that works for me is God's grace to me. Finding a church that, you know, will rally around me and bring me meals when I'm sick, that's grace to me. A husband who's been faithful to me for 21 years, while I've been sick, while I've been, you know, I mean, I'm definitely not the girl that he married when he thought we were going to travel the world and be missionaries and have adventures. You know, he's worked a hard, laboring construction job for 21 years to provide and be faithful for me. That's grace, you know? So I see those things. I see, you know, it may be hard. It may not look ideal, but God is incredibly faithful to us if we learn to see it and call it out.
When we're looking at these factors of glorious weakness, what is the biggest detriment in our Christian lives of fully depending upon God when we think that we're strong? What's the biggest deterrent from us fully trusting in God's grace in our weakness?
I think, you know, it comes down to us believing that God's going to hold out on us. I think there is a mindset where we think we still have to get and provide for ourselves. We still have to earn a way. We still have to be pleasing in some way. We still have to prove ourselves. And, you know, I think it's one part insecurity, one part pride, which are, you know, they kind of are the two sides to the same coin. I think we feel a lot of that, you know, when I first became a Christian, I had a lot of shame. I had been molested as a child. I felt like I was displeasing and dirty. I didn't believe that God could love me and let that happen. I doubted his goodness. I doubted his provision. I saw him as this God of scarcity, sort of this second-hand God that just only has leftovers for me. And that was really the way that I saw him throughout my youth. And then I became a Christian and you know, got to know him more. But then it became about sort of this legalistic, you know, following all the rules, being the right person, clean the outside of the cup, always seem you know, right, always have the right answer and the scripture memorized and the, you know, everything tidy. And I think that I had so much doubt that if I let loose all of my questions and all of my fears and, you know, that heart crying out to God, in desperation, that somehow maybe he would let me down. Somehow maybe he would not have the answer. Maybe he wouldn't be enough, you know? And I think that question, is God enough? Like, is he really enough? When you're going through all this stuff, like, is he really enough when you're standing there and you've lost everything? Can you still cry out to God, you know, though you slay me, yet will I trust you? Like, can you get to that place? And I think that some of the biggest deterrent is that we really don't think that God is enough. You know, we really don't. And a lot of us have never had the chance to prove that God is enough, because we always have plan B. We always have, you know, that safety net in our back pocket. We always have something to, I mean, I think that's a lot of times why you see people in health crisis and different things have sort of this awakening of their faith, because all of a sudden they realize that all the insulation didn't do any good against cancer, or all of the insulation didn't do any good against whatever tragedy that they're dealing with. And all of a sudden they are at this reckoning place. Is God enough? Will he get me through this? Can I trust him? Does he love me? You know? And then it's sort of this crucible of testing. Are you a faithful God that will meet me in this? But I think a lot of people, we don't want to venture there, unless we're forced to. And, we don't like to feel unsafe. We don't like to, it's scary to trust. It's scary to believe. It's scary to have faith. It's scary to step out in the unknown and say, are you going to catch me? And, you know, I think our society frowns on it even, you know. I think radical faith in God, and I'm not talking about some, you know, going out to some crazy thing or doing some, but radical faith in God, just believing he is who he says he is sort of frowned on in our society. You know, it seems foolish to trust God so completely. It seems foolish to not make your own way. I think it's a hard thing to reckon with, what trusting and faithfulness and weakness is going to look like in each person's life. But I think everything in our society fights against it. Everything in our society says you need to seek your own happiness and your own success and your own power and your own strength. And, you know, it goes against the Bible saying that our strength is only in Christ. That's really the only place we're ever going to find it. And that to find it, we come weak and desperate.
Do you think that one of the reasons why we fail to see the real value of grace is because we tend to surround ourselves with people who make us feel stronger than we actually are, that we surround ourselves with people that only talk about the good points, and we don't bring up a lot of these issues in our public, in our church setting, that will allow us opportunities to work through the variables that might be happening all around us?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is definitely the culture, different church culture. I mean, there are churches that are very open and vulnerable and talk about the hard stuff, but I think it's, in general, I think that's a rare thing from the things that I've heard from a lot of my readers. They don't feel like they're a safe place to really be themselves in the midst of whatever they're going through, to really cry out in that sort of pain. I mean, I think even in terms of, like, just the Christian, you know, I've read some of the Psalms, and I think if I were to write a blog post like one of these Psalms, I would get comments of people being like, there would be this sort of like, you can't be that honest with God. Because some of those are cliffhangers, you know, some of those Psalms, they leave you in that place of like, oh, like, he's just in the dark, you know? And he's confessing all of this and he's crying out. But there's even this, like, are you doing this to me, Lord? You know, and I think there are times where I think, gosh, if you wrote a blog post like that on a Christian thing, like, there would have to be some sort of twist at the end Or you'd get people that are like, what are you saying? Are you losing your faith? Are you having this crisis of your faith? Are you backsliding? Are you, you're not having a quiet time. You're not having enough Bible scripture. You're not having enough community. Like whatever the thing is, the deficit, they would see this deficit in weakness. They would see that there's something, they would feel like there's something wrong with your declarations of, pain or isolation or loneliness or fear, all of those things, and I think we don't make space for that in our society a lot. I don't know that we always surround ourselves with people that give the happy answers. I think we're just used to, how many times have you been at church and somebody said, how are you doing? And you're not doing great, but you say fine, mm-hmm. right? Because one, the person's headed to the coffee and doing their own thing, and they're not really expecting you to say, I'm actually really struggling, and my antidepressant hasn't worked. I've barely been able to get out of bed, and my marriage is falling apart, and my kids are, I have a prodigal kid that's doing all, nobody goes there, right? You just say fine, and you smile, and you move on, and I think we are a society that says fine and moves on way too much. And I think people are longing for something real and authentic to connect to, a God that doesn't just say, oh, she's fine, and moves along, a God that digs down deep underneath and says, what's really hurting you? What's really going on? And how can we meet each other in that? And that is the work of the body. That is the work of the church. It's something that we have to get better at. I think, I talk in my book about lament. We are a culture, North American culture is not good at lament. We don't have a concept of it, of corporately lamenting and crying out to God. I just don't think that that's really a part of a lot of our worship, but a part of how we conduct ourselves. And so there is this sort of, even with grief, there is sort of this time allotment. This is how long you normal people grieve for, and then you kind of move on. Or this is how long you're allowed to suffer and seem brave, and everybody will tell you. With me, with mental illness, there are times when people say, oh, you're so brave, right? For talking about it or for, whatever. But that's a short period of time, because eventually people expect you to get better, right? That's the goal, is that you get better. But what happens when you have a mental illness that, barring a miraculous healing from God, I will probably have this for the rest of my life, and I will continue to have cycles and bouts. And I'm a rapid cycling bipolar disorder, so finding meds that work for me long term are really hard. Sometimes I'm on medicine and it just stops working, and I don't ever know when that's, sometimes I have a really long spell and I'm doing great. And sometimes it's just constantly trying to find that balance between my moods and my depression and my mania and all of these things. And if that goes on and on and on, people, it gets old. People get tired of it. We want the happy ending. We want the testimony. We want the before and after. We want the person that gets up and says, I was this, and then God, and now this. But we don't want the testimony that gets up and says, I was this, and then God, and then still this, and this, and this, and this, but God is faithful. It's harder to hear, it's harder to realize that for some people, that happy ending isn't coming in this lifetime in that way. And for them to still declare the goodness and faithfulness of God is powerful, but I don't think we see that a lot, because I don't think we see a lot of people ministering from these places of weakness. We want the victory story. We want the success story. We want the after that looks like, the miraculous healing and the money that came in and the provision and the, we want that. That's what we as a society have been groomed to believe is the goodness and blessing of God, that everything will be tidy and fixed, rather than just that God will be present and that he knows, even when we don't know, why life is the way that it is.
We've been seeing a lot of our culture responding to depression and mental illness that's happening all around us. We're seeing our culture really kind of deal with it as a reality in our society, but yet this really hasn't been addressed in large part by the church. We're seeing it from outside of the church. How does this What does that mean to you to see the real struggle that you faced your whole life in the church, and to see now the kind of culture embrace this need, but still there be a stigma for it amongst Christians?
Yeah, you know, I think it's almost worse of a stigma in Christians because of that idea of the before and after. Because if you're a Christian, you know, for me to say, I wrote an article that was about books in my book that went up on Christianity Today, and it talks about being suicidal. And I remember when we were working through some of the pieces, I wanted to make sure that at the end, so, you know, it basically talks about the time when I got saved. It was during a time when I was severely suicidal, and you know, so it's in the book, it's longer, but anyway, God made his presence known to me, and I am still here. But I wanted to be really clear that it wasn't just that one time. I've been a Christian now for several decades, and you know, faithfully have seen God's hand work in my life, and yet I still at times struggle with suicidal ideation. And people have a really hard time reconciling. How can you be a Christian and still think that way and be so full of despair and so hopeless that you would feel, you know, that you would think that way, that you would struggle with that? People don't understand it as what it is. And so I think in the church, because of that, we've been slower to have the conversations. The conversations have been... there are a lot of people that write to me that their church has discouraged them from seeking counseling or taking medication, believing that faith and prayer and, you know, those things are all that they need. There have been people devastated. We've lost people that have lost this battle. 1 in 4 people with bipolar disorder will attempt to take their own lives. And, you know, that's a catastrophic blow to you, to the image of God, right? That's a person. That's a person that God loves. That's their family. That's their kids. That's their coworkers. That's their community. And yet we don't talk about it because there's a shame that they were somehow, you know, even the way that we talk about it, we talk about suicide in just a very, you know, there's people that have been in the church who have lost their lives, and it's such a complicated thing, you know, the way that we grieve and the way that, you know, there's so many people that are like, how could they do that? And it's so selfish. I mean, even my own husband, when I was talking, you know, one of the first times I confessed to him that I was struggling with these things and I needed help, he was so angry. And he was like, how could you be that? You know, we have 3 kids that love you and depend. He was just, you know, he could not understand. You know, he thought this was a choice that I was, the selfish indulgence that I was, you know, and I was saying, I need you to understand, like, my brain is not working right. This is what I'm thinking. And I don't want to not be here. And that's why I'm telling you, I need help. Because I do want to stay here. And I do realize that, but at the same time, my brain is not working. And these are the thoughts that I'm struggling with. And so I think, you know, some of the idea of talking about this stuff in the church, there are so, for every post that I would write about depression or mental illness or, you know, suicidal ideation, and I would get, you know, some comments and some tweets and some social media stuff. And then I would get an inbox and private messages filled with people saying, I can't talk about this in my life because I'm a, you know, an elder, or I'm a pastor, or I'm a pastor's wife. I work for the school system. There's no safe place for me to talk about the struggles that I have because of my position, because of what people would think, because it would ruin my chances for advancement, because people would question my judgment, because, you know, all of these things. And so these people are suffering through, you know, these horrendous times and struggles with mental illness virtually alone. And so there's such a need. There's such a need to talk about it and to realize that faithful, God-fearing people who love Jesus can still struggle, can and will struggle with mental illness. That is part of this broken world and this life that we live. That is something that happens, and that we need to be a place that accepts that people will come hurting and broken in this way, and that they shouldn't be stigmatized, that this should be a place to come and meet Jesus.
What advice do you have for any of our listeners who are connecting with your story because they feel the kind of frustration of this internal struggle that they're facing all of the time with their doubts and the questions about why they're thinking the way they're thinking, why they're struggling the way that they're struggling? And what advice do you have for them on what they can do in seeing this in a beautiful way through the grace that we have been given through Jesus Christ?
Well, they should buy my book because we talk about a lot of this in depth. I think that to see that and to start having your eyes open, I think, asking God, give me eyes to see. I don't know how long I prayed that. I don't know how, much I still, give me eyes to see. Because God's faithful and he does, having a heart that's willing to be open, to God intervening. God is a God who is disruptive. He likes to make his presence known, and we can ask for that. I think that learning to pay attention to those things, I think learning to know the character of God, for me, I read the Bible for years, only seeing it through, one lens of a to-do thing of how I was supposed to do. Reading it to look for God's character instead of a list of how I should be, reading it to look for how God is, how God is, really helped me to understand my identity as beloved, that I'm beloved no matter what, that I'm beloved and it's finished, that I'm beloved and Christ's work is enough. I think that realization comes from knowing God, not only in our lives to see his faithfulness, but in scripture to see the goodness that he pours out on his people. And so that's a good place to start. I think community is essential. This is a tricky one. It's interesting. I get a lot of things from people that are really lonely, and it's hard because a lot of times my first advice is not necessarily to go and confess everything in church. I'm wary sometimes because a lot of churches have been really, whether intentional or not, have been really painful and traumatic and damaging to people that are this fragile. And I wish that that wasn't the case. I wish that I could say just across the board, go to your pastor, go to your church, go find community and a body and be able to share this stuff and help, other people, come along and shoulder that burden. Unfortunately, I think that sometimes I'm wary of giving that advice because we haven't had all of these conversations in church, and it's not always a safe place for people with mental illness to be as honest about this stuff as we need to be. But I still, community is essential. Community is vital, and having a body that supports you during this time is really, there's really no way around the fact that God calls us to be a body, calls us to be a church. I think those are some sort of practical things. I think finding one or two people that you can be, gut level honest with that will stay, and being able to confess everything that you're going through, having safe people. For me, that's my husband and my mom, people that I can share all of everything, my psychiatrist, and I can say all of the things, and they're not going to run away from me or be freaked out. They're going to walk with me through that. That's been a huge grace in my life, and I know not everybody has that. And so that's hard. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy journey. But there are ways to make it through this, and there are ways that, I'm dealing right now with a loved one who is going through a severe depression. And I keep saying, there's hope on the other side. You just need to hang on. There's hope coming. And I talk in my book about learning the language of hope, staying fluent in the language of hope and the ways that we do that, that our native tongue as Christians is hope, and that God gives us that. He tells us we have a bright future. He tells us, what is coming, and that we live in the kingdom sort of in this in between, right? You know, here, but still coming, the kingdom come. And what does it look like to yearn for that and yet still be grounded here? What does it look like to yearn for the kingdom of God to come, to usher it in and still be grounded here and thankful for the work that he does in our everyday lives? And it's a journey, definitely not an easy one, but it's one that has a tremendous amount of beauty and grace and potential if we, if we're willing, you know. I think sometimes we just don't ask. We just don't believe that we can be as honest about God and to God as we can. You know, I think if I learn anything, it's how honest I can be with God. He's not shocked by my humanity, you know. He's not shocked by my weakness. He's not offended by me. I can be honest and I can ask, and he's a good, kind and tender God, and he hears me.
Some great advice. I wish we could go on for much longer. There's so many more questions that I would have, but like you said, our listeners are going to have to buy your book. Some great stuff as we've been talking with Aaliyah Joy about her book, Glorious Weakness, Discovering God in All That We Lack. It's a great resource. Find out more information by giving us a call. It's 508-362-7070. Aaliyah, thank you so much for being a part of the Many Voices for That One Message. Thank you for sharing your story, being honest and vulnerable with us, but also demonstrating the true beauty of the grace of God.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this interview made possible by our ministry at Songtime Radio. You can find out more information about our ministry by visiting our website at songtime.com, where you can find this and other interviews on our podcast series, as well as our weekday broadcast, which includes teaching, interviews, and music. We also want to encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's got encouraging articles, and there is no obligation. To find out more information about our ministry, again, visit our website at songtime.com. This ministry is made possible by people just like yourself. We are 100% supported by our listeners. So if you have been blessed today, why not join with the many voices together for that one message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, with your donation to the Songtime Ministry. To make a donation, you can do so online at our website at songtime.com, as well as by mail. Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. Make a donation over the phone. It's 508-362-7070. On behalf of our entire Songtime staff and our own Dr. John DeBrine, the founder here at Songtime, who encourages you to grow in grace and not groan in disgrace, from Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller. God bless.